whichever it might be, enraged Speller and Helwaz, and everyone trying to make the best of things, trying to find a way forward. "Why be so negative?" they asked.
"It's not me being negative," Aram would reply. "It's the universe obeying its laws. Science isn't magic. We aren't fantasy creatures. We have been dealt a hand."
"So what do we do?" Helwaz said angrily. "What are we supposed to do, in your opinion?"
Aram shrugged at this. Freya called into the meeting that was discussing the situation, from the spine where she was just now coming down, in the last group of peacemakers. She said, "We should go home." Silence greeted this pronouncement. Air vents, electrical hums.
"What do you mean?"
Speller asked. Freya's voice came through the speakers clearly, even loudly.
"We should resupply the ship and fly it back to Earth. If we succeed, our descendants will survive. There's no other option we have now where you can say that. It's too bad, but it's true."
The people on the plaza in Yangtze looked around at each other, silenced. Her idea, which she explained in the days that followed, had originated with Yuan. It was also something Devi used to mention, she said. It was a good idea, she said. A workable plan. Clearly, it shocked people. In all that was going on, it seemed too much to take in. Freya herself spent most of her time cajoling, and in certain cases, physically threatening people to get out of the spokes and stay in the biomes. Teams organized by the Security Council took over at every spoke lock and began to work like one-way valves, allowing people to leave the spokes but not to enter them. Eventually, a point came where it was possible to persuade or coerce everyone still in the spine and spokes to descend into the biomes. People then gradually dispersed to their hometowns or gathered with like-minded people to make further plans. The individuals responsible for the deaths of the settlers in the dock slipped among their supporters, and those groups resisted any calls for a further investigation of what had happened. Clearly, no one had wanted people to die, it was often said. It had been an accident, a disaster. Time to move on. Time to figure out what to do next. Thus, in a continuing tumult of the spirit, with many still grief-stricken, still furious, all actions possible to them at this point were in effect dumped on the table and inspected at length. It did not seem like the right time for this, but there was no stopping it either. It was the only thing worth talking about, given their situation. Freya's proposal was one of the actions discussed. That it was Devi's daughter proposing the idea gave it a certain weight that it might not have had otherwise. Devi was missed, her death a wound that had not healed. Often people wondered what she would have done in the situations they now found themselves in. There was a kind of slippage in which, since Freya had suggested the plan, it seemed to be Devi's plan. And though Freya was the first to speak the idea out loud, she hadn't been the first to think it. They had to do something, go somewhere, and it was undeniable that the solar system was at least a destination they could trust to sustain them, if they could get there. Still, this was only one plan among several now discussed. One faction, including their old friend Song, argued for sterilizing Aurora and proceeding there as originally planned. As the pathogen on Aurora was so poorly understood, Aram was coming to feel that Yoki had not actually identified it. This group was small, and its arguments seemed not to persuade many, especially among those who had been involved with the deaths of the returning settlers. Part of their justification for the dock disaster now lay in claiming that Aurora was irredeemably poisonous. Speller and his faction continued to argue for going on in the ship to RR Prime. Helwaz and a large group advocated inhabiting F's second moon. And quite a few began to assert that they could simply stay on the ship and use the various planetary bodies of the Tau Ceti system
to resupply whatever they might lack, filling the metabolic rifts as they occurred. From the ship, they could consider their options and perhaps work on both Aurora and F's second moon. In all the arguing, there were some people attempting to model the options. Unfortunately, their modeling work led most of the modelers to conclude that no plan available to them was likely to succeed. They had very few options, and none were good, and for the most part, they were mutually exclusive. Bitterness and anger grew in people as the modelers' conclusions became known. The spine was emptied now and under guard by people who had agreed to enforce the Security Council's edicts. The stern dock was physically sealed off. Yoki was sequestered in his ferry, held magnetically inside Inner Ring A. On one level, the situation seemed calm. People had returned to their biomes and resumed their lives there, and were dealing with crops that had been neglected and now had to be planted or harvested. Animals had to be cared for, machines had to be tended. But things were not well with them. Now, more than ever before in the history of the ship, their isolation began to press on them. No one could help them govern themselves, nor make the decisions they now had to make. They were alone with all that. It was up to them. Freya wandered the biomes as she had in her wandering years. She did not speak in the meetings she attended, or in the cafes where she had worked just a few years previously, but merely listened. She stood at the back of a room like the figurehead of a sailing ship, or sat in a corner looking at each speaker mutely. As she wandered, she inspected each biome with a close regard. How was it doing? She asked the inhabitants. What had it been good for during the voyage out? Could it continue to help them to survive another 170 years of enclosure if they decided to go back? She found that some of the biomes that were doing the best in ecosystem terms were in fact the least useful to the ship's humans during a voyage. These biomes had been brought along to convey their species to the new world, to help terraform the planet they were to have established. As farms, they were less useful. But it occurred to Freya that they could be altered to make them better farms. Going back to the solar system, they would not be needed as seed banks or arcs. Song's idea was this: proceed with the inhabitation of Aurora by introducing to it their Terran bacteria and viruses, in the hope that after a war of microbiota, Aurora would end up habitable by humans. Some of their ecologists and bacteriologists thought that might work. The group centered on Helwaz and Bao called for them to inhabit and terraform F's second moon, the best of the remaining candidates for inhabitation in the Tau Ceti system. It was a Mars analog and had been their previous second option, and there was no reason it wouldn't work. Speller continued to lead those who said they should move on, that they should refuel and resupply the ship and head to the star RR Prime. They would cross interstellar space for another 80 years and try again in that system, which in many ways looked so promising. Or they could stay in the ship and live in it in perpetuity. Or they could go back to the solar system. All these ideas were discussed endlessly in every possible iteration. As they talked, there grew a sense among many of them that if they stayed in the Tau Ceti system, they could combine some of these options, which were not in the deepest sense mutually exclusive. They could try again on Aurora, with test inoculations of bacteria and so on, while proceeding on F's second moon, and refurbish the ship while living on it, and inspect and explore F's first moon. Options, yes. Just no good ones, others said. Different ways of running out the string. Different ways of going extinct after a long, fruitless struggle, trapped in chambers even smaller than the ship's biomes. But they could live in the biomes. But they couldn't live in the biomes. Freya spoke very little in public.
But in private, she continued to assert that their best chance would be to resupply the ship and head back to Earth. It was the one destination they had where they knew their descendants could survive.
But of course,
Speller said, dropping by the little cafe in Olympia where Freya was staying the night.
But what's the point of that? Why did we ever leave? Why have we gone through all this, we and all our ancestors and descendants, if not to make it work here?
Freya shook her head at her old friend and said, they never should have left. They talked and talked and talked. 24 biomes, 10,000 conversations. Talk, talk, talk. As they talked, it began to come clear to them that they had no very effective method of governance when it came to making decisions as a group. Had humans ever had such a thing, they asked themselves, since leaving the savannah? Since congregating in cities? They could not be sure. The history suggested maybe not. In the ship, ever since the troubles of year 68, the four generations that followed had been careful to work within the system established after that upheaval, always deliberating peacefully toward consensus on all important decisions. Now even the definition of consensus was contested, and they came to realize that their political system, simple as it was, had never faced a crisis. Suspended in their voyage as they had been, there had never been anything to choose, except methods of homeostasis. Now the test was upon them, and very quickly, cracks in their facade of civility began to appear. Where there is faction, there is conflict. Where there is conflict, there is anger. And anger distorts judgment. So now they were getting angry with each other, and thus scared of each other. And anger and fear were not the right emotions for the situation facing them. In the wake of the events of year 68, the survivors had settled on a government of representative democracy based on a constitution setting out their political first principles. The first principles were to be upheld in everything they decided to do. More than anything else, the survivors understood that they needed to behave in ways that kept a balanced flow of elements going in their closed life support system. To do this, their population had to be capped at no more than 2,152 people. There were also population caps for all the rest of the mammals on board. Within these carrying capacities, a maximum amount of individual human autonomy was to be maintained. But this necessarily did not include the right to reproduce, nor did it include free movement around the ship, at least in terms of residency. Each biome had its own particular carrying capacities, nor could certain jobs and functions be neglected by the totality of the group. Any number of jobs simply had to be performed, or the ship would not remain in working balance, able to support them over the long haul of interstellar solitude. So habitation, reproduction, education, work. All expressed ecological necessities. They had to attend to these or go extinct. That was just the way it was. That was reality. Everyone was taught that in childhood. There were limits. There were needs. Every person in the ship was part of the team, integral to society, necessary to the survival of the group. Everyone was equal in that respect and had to be treated the same as everyone else. Only within that set of first principles, after fulfilling the necessities, could they find and exercise what liberties were still left. Some said that what remained was trivial, but no one had any suggestions as to how to give themselves more liberties than what they had, given their constraints. Duty first. So, now each biome's population met in a town meeting. Anyone who wanted to speak, spoke. This lasted for 2 weeks, after which a series of polls and votes were held. They polled themselves to get an accurate count on the questions at hand. Who preferred what course of action? How many for each? And how strongly did they feel about it? Then in most biomes, there was a vote for representatives. One representative for every 100 people. In most towns, there was no campaigning. People voted anonymously. Those elected who also agreed to serve then spoke to their neighbors about what they should say in the General Assembly. In other biomes, they chose representatives by lottery, and those selected had to promise to speak for the majority opinion in their biome, or in some, merely to do what they thought right. These representatives then met in Costa Rica, in the town of San Jose, and discussed matters in a general conference. This was an open-ended conference, the idea being that when everyone had discussed matters thoroughly, a poll would be taken of the entire population, and then the representatives would be tasked with executing the will of the majority of the people. If it turned out to be close to a split decision, which they decided meant any minority vote larger than 33%, then they would work on ways to ameliorate the situation by finding some kind of middle ground if they could. Successive votes would be taken until a supermajority of 67%, or hopefully more, agreed on a course of action. At that point, the minority would have to accept the judgment of the majority. That was the theory. While trying to come to a decision, they agreed to ask the ship to relocate itself to Tau Ceti's planet F and enter into orbit around F's second moon. This was to make a reconnaissance, to judge that moon better for habitability. As ship made this transfer, which took 7 months following a Hohmann path of least energy expenditure and used 2.4% of ship's remaining fuel supply, the policy discussion raged on. Meanwhile, many biologists on board studied samples of the Auroran pathogen, which Yoki kept in a sealed room in his ferry, a room that he had turned into a clean lab, teleoperated by him. There were still those who supported Song's idea that they could learn to live with this Auroran thing if they could understand it better. So the studying of the pathogen went on, even though they never settled on what to call it. Vector. Disease. Pathogen. Invasive species. Bug. These were all earthly terms, and Aram, for one, regarded them as various kinds of category error.
"The best we can do in terms of terminology," he said, "is to call it the alien."
That it definitely was. The individual protein-like samples Yoki had isolated and put into an electron microscope that was sent over to him were so small that it was hard to understand how they could be alive. They were certainly alive in some senses of the term, since they reproduced, but it was hard to tell how or what else they did. In this, they shared qualities with viruses and their viri, prions, and RNA, but in other ways, they did not seem similar to any of these entities. Processes were happening within them at nanometer scale, even picometer scale. But what was small enough for them to eat? How could they eat? Or to put it more simply, where did they get their energy? How did they grow? Why did they grow so quickly when they got inside a human? These were unsolved mysteries, and might remain so for a long time. Meanwhile, F's second moon, now named Iris by the proponents of settling there, proved to be an almost completely water-free rock ball, as suspected. Iron core, magnetic field, dry except for a little frozen comet debris on its surface, which was heavily cratered, also indented by two long, straight canyons, possibly the result of early fractures. Somewhat of a big Mercury by analog, appearance, and possibly history, its heavy core testified perhaps to a collision in its early days that had stripped off a lighter outer shell of rock, which had subsequently fallen onto F, rather than be completely recollected out of orbit by Iris. This, anyway, was the best originary model to explain the data. Its 1.23G was rather discouraging, but it had a little rotation, and it was not completely tidally locked to F, which fact also supported the idea of an early collision. It thus had a day that was 30 days long, a month orbiting F that was 20 days long, and F's year was 650 days long. F's orbit was 1.36 AU from Tau Ceti. Its insulation from Tau Ceti, 28.5% that of Earth's. Truly, it was at the very outer edge of the habitable zone, but still, it had a lot of sunlight to work with. The lack of water on Iris, which used to be seen as a problem, now reassured people. Water was now felt to be dangerous, as it seemed likelier than ever that liquid water anywhere would harbor life of some kind and create problems. The sample size of data supporting this conclusion remained very small, consisting as it did of Earth, Europa, Ganymede, Enceladus, and Aurora. But Aurora had been traumatic. It was even suggested that the cometary ice on Iris could be removed if there were any suspicion that it contained the Auroran pathogen. Others pointed out that the ice some proposed to import to Iris to give their new world a hydrosphere and atmosphere would be ice from F's Moon 1, or cometary ice from Tau Ceti's crowded Oort cloud. So if ice anywhere was potentially a home for life, then they could never escape that. But there was no reason to think that was the case. It was generally agreed that it was liquid water that was likely to hold life, not ice. A lot of ice had condensed out of the original cloud of interstellar dust that had formed Tau Ceti, and there was no reason to think life had ever had a chance to begin in that ice. So it was assumed they would be safe if they ended up giving Iris a little ocean composed of imported cometary ices. So, hydrate Iris, introduce Terran genomes, occupy. F itself would then be a gorgeous marble in Iris's sky, a gas giant full of volatiles they would surely need. A giant ball of feedstocks right next door, and its huge beauty helping them occupy Iris by way of its reflected sunlight, which would illuminate all of Iris as Iris slowly turned, and not just one hemisphere, as it had been on Aurora. Really, it looked very promising. But how long would it take to terraform Iris? Nothing but guesses could answer this question, and the guesses depended on many assumptions one necessarily had to enter as numbers into one's models. The median times calculated by the models was privately judged by the ship to be about 3,200 years, with outlier estimates ranging from 50 to 100,000 years. Obviously, the models and parameters chosen made quite a difference. In fact, the problem was poorly constrained. Still, it seemed fair to assume that the median estimate had some kind of theoretical validity. Many people in the ship didn't want to wait 3,000 years, or however long it might take to terraform Iris. Others didn't think they could last that long. Others didn't think it would take that long.
The models must be wrong, some said. Surely once life got started on a planet, it would change things fast. Bacteria reproduce very quickly in an empty ecological niche.
But on Earth it took a billion years. But there was only archaea on Earth. With the full suite of bacteria, it would go fast. Not where there isn't an atmosphere. Bacteria on rock, exposed to the vacuum, doesn't grow very fast. It mostly dies, in fact.
So we need self-replicating robot machinery to make soil, to make air, to add water.
But the self-reps need feedstocks. Collecting the necessary materials can only be accomplished by a first generation of robots, and that won't be fast. We can print printers and thrive. It can be done. We can do it. Our robots can do it. It's going to take too long. In the meantime, we'll die out. Evolve at differential rates and diverge right inside our own bodies. Zoo devolution. Code evolution. Sicken and die and go extinct. sicken and die and never once leave this ship.
So that maybe,
Freya kept saying,
we need to go back home.
The day came when they tried to make a choice. Strange, perhaps, to wake up one morning, get dressed, eat breakfast, all the while knowing that one was going off to a meeting that would change the world. Decisions are hard. Everyone has the halting problem. Freya sat next to Badim at their kitchen table, restlessly pushing around cut strawberries with a fork.
What do you think will happen?
She asked. Badim smiled at her. He looked unusually cheerful and was eating heartily, chomping on pieces of buttered toast and washing them down with milk.
It's interesting, eh?
He said between bites.
Up until today, history was preordained. We were aimed at Tau Ceti. Nothing else could happen. We had to do the necessary.
He waved his bread in the air.
Now that story is over. We are thrust out the end of that story. Forced to make up a new one, all on our own.
They walked together to the tram station, then got on a crowded tram car and headed east to Costa Rica. In the biomes along the way, the tram stopped and more full cars were linked to it. First in Olympia, then Amazonia. Mostly the people in the tram cars were subdued. People looked pensive. 102,563 conversations had been recorded in the previous month that were about this topic, and there were conflict markers in grammar and semantics in 88% of these conversations, which were inevitably held mostly between people well known to each other. Now, they were done with that. 170.170. The General Assembly called for in Costa Rica brought 620 people to the Government House Plaza. Most of the rest of the ship's population watched the assembly on screens throughout the ship. But another meeting, called In Opposition to the Tyranny of the Majority, drew 273 people to the plaza in Kiev in the steppes. San Jose's Government House Plaza occupied much of the middle of town. It was surrounded by 4- and 5-story buildings, all faced with white stone, cut to a fussy pattern of interlocking rectangles. The overall impression was of some stage set imitating a European capital, but that could be said of many real European capitals, so it was possibly based on a real square somewhere back on Earth. Ship saw resemblances to Vienna, Moscow, Brasilia. Now about a third of the population of the ship stood in the plaza, listening to speakers rehash various aspects of the matter at hand. People clumped in cohorts based mostly on home biomes. After the speeches began, the flow between groups was minimal. Some people sat on the smooth flagstones of the plaza. Others had brought folding chairs and stools. Still others stood. There were some open-walled dining tents to provide food and drink, and what circulation there was in the crowd mostly led to and from these tents. One sequence of speakers described the plan to shift their efforts to F's second moon, all of them now calling it Iris. They would establish a base on its surface and move down into that base as they built it to full size. They would add water to the surface by way of a comet bombardment, which would also create the beginnings of an atmosphere. The self-replicating robots and factories would build shelters, break volatiles into gases, create an atmosphere and soil, and shape the growing hydrosphere as it fell from the sky. They would introduce their bacteria to this virgin surface, and it would quickly expand to fill this truly empty ecological niche. After the archaea and bacteria and fungi were established on the ground, they would help to bulk up the atmosphere and to create the soil. And soon, further plants and animals from the starship could be introduced, in waves of succession similar to what had occurred in Terran evolution. And the planet terraformed thereby in rapid order, at a speed literally a million times faster than it had happened naturally on Earth, meaning 3,000 years instead of 3 billion. with the chance of doing it in 300 years also very real, if things went faster than expected. The various components of this plan were described in some detail by Helwaz, and in this effort, she was joined by Song. They had joined forces, Song having agreed to the Iris plan with the idea that as an extension of it, her plan for returning to Aurora could be pursued. For now, she agreed with Helwaz that terraforming Iris was the best plan, whether interim or permanent. People stood or sat in silence, listening. Then Aram was invited to the podium. He stood for a moment, staring down at the people, then spoke.
The problem is this. The spaces we have available to live in are too small to survive in for 3,000 years. The main problem is the differential rates of evolution between the various orders of life confined to the space. Bacteria generally mutate at a rate far faster than larger species, and the effect of that evolution on the larger species is eventually devastating. This is one cause of the dwarfism and higher rates of extinction seen in island biogeography studies. And we are an island, if there ever was one. And this Iris is not an Earth twin, nor an Earth analog. It is a Mars analog. There are also chemicals we need that can't be found on a rock planet that has never harbored life. In short, the supraorganism that we all constitute together can't survive over that long a time in the confinement we would be subjected to.
It was Speller who picked up one of the other microphones on the podium.
How can we know anything except by trying it?
Aram said,
The modeling involved here has been tested, and we can state certain ecological outcomes as very likely, even though the likelihoods decrease if you push them farther out in time. You are very welcome to review the studies involved. We have made them public at every point.
But some of the scenarios show the terraforming as succeeding, correct?
Aram nodded.
There are some scenarios that succeed, but they occur at a rate of only about 1 in 1,000.
But that's fine, Speller smiled broadly. That's the one we'll make happen.
Grimly, Aram faced the crowd. The silence in the plaza was such that one could hear the food orders in the corner and the children playing, and the squealing of the seagulls wheeling over the rooftops between the plaza and Costa Rica's Salt Lake. Speller and Helwaz and Song made more rebuttals to Aram. Those who agreed with Aram formed a separate line to speak, and the organizers of the assembly began to let people from the two lines speak in alternation, until it became clear from the muttering from the crowd, including even short bursts of laughter as each new talk began, that the effect of the alternation was unhelpful. Contemplating two starkly different futures back and forth was perhaps too much like a debating society exercise, but because the topic debated was life or death for them, the back and forth engendered first cognitive dissonance, then estrangement. Some laughed, others looked sick. Existential nausea comes from feeling trapped. It is an affect state resulting from the feeling that the future has only bad options. Of course, every human faces the fact of individual death, and therefore existential nausea must be to a certain extent a universal experience, and something that must be dealt with by one mental strategy or another. Most people appear to learn to ignore it, as if it were some low chronic pain that has to be endured. Here in this meeting, it began to become clear, for many of those present, that extinction lay at the end of all their possible paths. This was not the same as individual death, but was instead something both more abstract and more profound. The crowd got restless. New speakers brought forth boos and catcalls, and people began arguing in the crowd. Some began to leak away from the edges of the gathering, and the plaza began to empty, even as the speakers on the central dais talked on. Those who left went away to complain, get drunk, play music, garden, work. Those organizing the event consulted with each other and decided not to call for a vote of the assembly at that time. Clearly the time was not right, nor the venue, nor the method of a voice vote or a tally by hands. Something more formal and private would be needed. Something like a mandatory vote, using secret ballots. Even this could not be decided at that bad moment, in the waning sun of Costa Rica's hot afternoon, with people streaming away into the streets and toward the trams. In the end, they called the meeting short, announcing that another would be held soon. In the week that followed the meeting, 15 people committed suicide, a 54,000% rise in frequency. Those who left suicide notes often spoke of their despair for the future. Why go on given such a situation? Why not end it now? An ancient proverb of Earth's first peoples. Every path leads to misfortune. A proverb from Earth's early modernity. Can't go on. Must go on. This was a human moment that never went away. An existential dilemma. A permanent condition. For them, in their particular situation, it came to this. When you discover that you are living in a fantasy that cannot endure, a fantasy that will destroy your world and your children, what do you do? People said things like, fuck it, or fuck the future. They said things like, the day is warm, or this meal is excellent, or let's go to the lake and swim. A plan had to be made, that was clear to all. But plans always concern an absent time, a time that when extended far enough into the future, would only be present for others who would come later. Thus, avoidance. Thus, a focus on the moment. Still in every meeting place, in every kitchen, the subject either came up or was avoided, and yet still hung there. What to do? They were inside a ship, sailing somewhere. A destination had to be chosen. Somehow. Freya and Badim spent much of their time in their apartment, waiting for the assembly's executive group to call for a referendum. Aram was again part of the executive group, and so they were hopeful that things would go well and get resolved soon, one way or the other. The Security Council had been suspended when all its functions were returned to the immediate business of the Executive Council. Freya sat looking at her father, his round, brown face, the drooping bags under his eyes. He looked much older than he had just 2 years before. None of them looked the same now. Ever since the death of the Aurora settlers, or even since Devi's death, they had changed, and now appeared to be aging faster than they had during the voyage out. A certain look was gone from them, possibly a sense of hope, possibly a feeling that things made sense, had meaning. 2 weeks after the assembly in San Jose, the executive group called for the referendum to be held the following day. Voting was mandatory, and any who refused to vote would be fined by punitive work penalties. In fact, this did not look like it was going to be a problem. It seemed as if everyone was anxious to cast a vote. The ballot had been arranged into three possible choices, with all the possibilities that kept them in the Tau Ceti system bunched as one choice. So the three were Tau Ceti, onward to RR Prime, back to Earth. Voting closed at midnight. At 12:02 a.m., the results were posted. Tau Ceti, 44%. Onward to RR Prime, 7%. Back to Earth, 49%. The roar of voices filled the biomes for many hours after that. Comments ranged as widely as could be imagined. In the following day, anything that could be said about the situation was said. It was a pluripotent response, an incoherence. The next morning, Aram dropped by Badim and Freya's apartment and said,
"Come with me to a meeting. We've been invited, and I think Freya is the one they really want."
"What kind of meeting?"
"Of people trying to avoid trouble. The referendum has by no means given anyone a mandate, so there could be trouble."
Freya and Badim went with him. Aram led them down to a public building by Long Pond, into a pub, and up the stairs to a big room with a window overlooking the water. There were four people there. Aram introduced Freya and Badim to them.
"Doris, Ketson, Tao, and Hester."
Then led them over to a table and invited them to sit. When they were seated, Aram sat beside Freya and leaned over to prop a screen on the table, where Badim could see it also.
"The referendum was too close," Aram said. "The most votes were cast for our preferred option, but we'll need to convince more people to join us. Convincing them might be easier if we make it clear that the ship can be made as strong as it was when it left the solar system."
Aram brought up charts on the table screen. Badim got out his reading glasses and leaned closer to read it. He said,
"What about our basic power supply? That would be my first question." "A good point, of course. The ship's main nuclear reactor has fuel for another 500 years, so we're okay there. As for propulsion fuel, we can send probes to gather hydrogen-3 and deuterium from Planet F's atmosphere. We would collect the same amount that we burn to decelerate coming in, and then burn it to accelerate out."
"But if we use it for accelerating," Badim said,
"how will we decelerate when we get back to the solar system?" "That too will have to be reversed. We'll have to ask the people in the solar system to point the laser beam that accelerated us back at us as we come in, to slow us down the same way they speeded us up. Possibly the same laser generator orbiting Saturn will be available."
"Really?"
Badim said.
"This is the plan?"
Then came a knock at the door. There were 32 people outside that door, 26 men and 6 women, several of the men taller and heavier than the median size of the population. Most of them were from Ring A biomes. When they were all in the room, it was extremely crowded. One of the men, Wan Sangyi from the steps, flanked by 3 of the biggest of the men, said,
"This is an illegal meeting. You are discussing public policy in a private gathering of political leaders, as specifically forbidden by the riot laws of year 68. So we are placing you under arrest. If you come peacefully, we'll let you walk. If you resist, you'll be tied to gurneys and carried."
"There is no law against private discussions of the health of the ship,"
Aram said angrily.
"It's you breaking the law here."
All their voices were now at least twice as loud as normal.
"Will you walk or be carried?"
Sangyi said.
"You'll definitely have to carry me,"
Aram said, and then charged Sangyi. In a melee filled with shouting, he was subdued by the men flanking Sangyi. Aram lashed out at Sangyi over one guard's shoulder as he was lifted off his feet, and his fist landed on Sangyi's nose. At the sight of blood, the others stuffing the room surged in toward Aram, shouting furiously. Badim stood over Freya in her chair, preventing her from rising to her feet.
"Stay out of this,"
he cried at her, face to face.
"This is not our fight here."
"Yes, it is,"
Freya shouted. But as she could not rise without throwing her father to the side, she kicked viciously past him as they clung to each other, striking nearby knees and causing some of their assailants to crash together and then fall to the floor, crying out angrily. Those still standing shouted and wrestled Badim and Freya both to the ground, pummeling and kicking them. Seeing this, Aram flew into a rage and struck out convulsively. More punched noses and cracked lips made several faces bloody, so that the white-eyed shouting redoubled again in volume and intensity. The sight of blood during a fight causes a very intense adrenaline surge. Voices shout hoarsely. Eyes go round, such that white is visible all the way around the iris. Movements are faster and stronger. Heart rate and blood pressure rise. This was demonstrated many times in year 68. The strategic foresight in bringing many large men to arrest the group in the room soon paid off, as the seven people in the meeting were, despite the close quarters and resultant chaos, knocked down, subdued, held fast, secured by medical restraints, lifted kicking out of the room and the building, laid onto gurneys in the street outside, and tied down to them. Badim and Freya were handled like all the rest, and Freya had a swollen left eye. The crowd that gathered to witness this action was composed almost entirely of people from Ring A biomes. Residents of the Fetch were slow to realize what was happening in their midst, and there was no effective resistance to this outside group. The gurneys were all conveyed up to the spine and along it to Spoke 3, and down it to the infirmary in Kiev, which had been used as a jail in year 68, though no one alive knew that. The seven arrested ones were locked up in three rooms there. Elsewhere in the ship, news of the incarceration of Aram's group spread fast. When their friends and supporters heard about it, they gathered in San Jose's plaza and loudly protested the action. The administrators of Costa Rica said they did not know what had happened and suggested discussing what to do in a regathering of a general assembly similar to the one just recently held. A significant number of the protesters refused to debate what they called a criminal action. Their friends had to be released immediately, and only then could any outstanding issues be discussed. Kidnapping could never be rewarded with political legitimacy, people shouted. Or else it would happen again and again, and there would be no more political discourse in the ship or rational planning of any kind. As that afternoon passed, the shouting became much like the sound of broken waves striking the corniche at the seawall of Long Pond. It was a roar. 3 hours after gathering, the crowd in San Jose had inspired itself to action and began marching toward Kiev, chanting slogans and singing songs. There were approximately 140 people in the crowd, and they had made it to the entryway of Spoke 4, packed around the tunnel there to a depth of around 200 meters, when a smaller crowd of approximately 50 people poured out of the Spoke tunnel, throwing rocks and shouting. It was as if fire and combustible fuel had come in contact. A furious fight erupted. It was still mostly a matter of shoving and hitting, but photos and clips of the melee were sent through the ship right in the midst of it, alerting all to the situation. Meanwhile, in all 12 biomes of Ring A, gangs stormed the government houses and took possession of them. Groups also seized and closed all the locks between Ring A's biomes, and likewise closed the 6 entryways to the A spokes. It seemed likely that these were coordinated actions, planned in spaces where the ship had no microphones, or where the microphones had somehow been rendered inoperative. Either that, or spontaneous actions self-organized very quickly, which of course they did in many phenomena. In the Spoke 4 lock, where the fighting still went on, news of developments elsewhere spread, and it became clear that the fight there was a kind of invasion of Ring B by the groups in Ring A that had taken possession of the government houses. The fight at the entry to Spoke 4 then became a pitched battle, with people from everywhere in Ring B rushing around through the locks to join the fray. Nonetheless, the attacking group continued to emerge from the Spoke entryway, more every minute, and they were taking over much of Costa Rica and many of the streets of San Jose. Rocks began to fly through the air. One struck a man in the head, and down he went, unconscious and bleeding. Now people were screaming. Reinforcements from around Ring B arrived, enough so that the group emerging from the Spoke was stopped in its advance on the government house. People on both sides now were hurling rocks from the parks, paving stones from the plazas, knives from kitchens, plates, other objects. Furniture was thrown out of buildings into the streets and piled into barricades, some of which were set on fire. Fire anywhere in the ship was extremely dangerous. Against such ferocious resistance, the invasive group could not hold its ground. More than a dozen people lay on the ground bleeding. As the invaders retreated to the lock of Spoke 4, still throwing objects at their opponents, there were groups elsewhere around Ring B hurrying up the other spokes toward the spine. The spine was already occupied by groups from Ring A, and they closed the entryway doors of B's inner ring all the way around, so that no matter how intense the assaults by people from Ring B, they could make no further progress toward the spine. And the spine held the power plant, along with all the other crucial central functions of the ship, including the ship's operating AI. So now Ring A and the spine were both controlled by people calling themselves the Stayers. No one who might want to free Aram and Freya and Badim and their four companions could come anywhere near the infirmary in Kiev. Instead, the antagonists were now separated by locked doors. And 16 people in Ring B were dead, killed either when hit by objects, or when cut or impaled, or when trampled by crowds. Another 96 people were injured. All the infirmaries in Ring B soon were filled with hurt people, and the medical teams in them were completely overwhelmed. 18 more people died in the following hours as a result of their injuries. The streets of San Jose were covered with wreckage and pools of congealing blood. The bad times had returned. In the infirmary in Kiev, Freya and the others had had their wrist pads and other communicators taken from them, which they obviously found shocking. Ketson still had an earbud that he had hidden when he was being searched, and listening to it, he relayed what he heard of the news of the fighting to the others with him in that room. Freya said, "With all that going on, I think we can escape these people here. They're sure to be distracted."
"How?" Aram asked.
"I know a way back to Ring B. Yuen taught it to me."
"But how will we get out of this building?"
"It's just an ordinary room. I don't think the locks or the door jams or the doors were made to stop someone from breaking them. These assholes are probably relying on guards to keep us in here, and the guards may be off dealing with this other stuff."
"The engineer's solution,"
Aram said.
"Why not?"
"Good question."
Aram put his ear to the door and listened for a while.
"Let's try it."
They took apart a bed frame in the room and used its footing to strike the doorknob. 42 strikes, and the doorknob broke off. Another 62 strikes, mostly made by Freya, broke the door latch assembly out of the door jamb, and the door swung open.
"Quick,"
Freya said. As they hurried down the hallway outside the room to a stairwell, a young man came out of another room and yelled at them to stop. Freya walked up to him, saying,
"Hey, we were just—"
and then punched him in the face. He fell back into the wall and slid to the floor, and though he tried to get up, he was too groggy to succeed. Freya leaned over and tore his wrist pad off his wrist, then led the others into the stairwell, where they descended to an exit onto the street outside. People had congregated at the screens outside a dining hall near the Great Gate of Kiev, and Freya and the others ran the other way, toward the lock leading to Mongolia and the end of Spoke 2. The lock door leading up to Spoke 2 was closed. The steppes biome was as far from Nova Scotia as one biome could be from another. Aram and Tau were in favor of them trying to make their way around Ring A to Tasmania, where they had friends in the eucalyptus forest they thought would take them in. Freya insisted they make for home.
"I know the way," she said. "Follow me."
She led them into Mongolia, and near the wall next to Spoke 2, she went to a little herder's shed with its slate roof, which she had visited 9 years before in an excursion with Yuen, She tapped out a code on the door pad.
You and you to make it my name, so I wouldn't forget, she said as she typed.
And then the lock released. And inside the shed, she got the others to help her move aside the big flagstones in the middle of the floor.
Come on, they'll be after us soon, and we'll be putting out a signal. I wouldn't doubt they have trackers on us somewhere, not to mention this wrist pad. Does anyone have a sweeper we can use to check?
No one did.
So we'll just have to be fast. Come on.
Under the flagstones was a narrow, dark tunnel that, after a U-turn and rise, led to a vent in the wall of Spoke 2. None of them had lights with them, but Freya judged it best that they move the flagstones back into place and walk in the resulting darkness, slightly lit by the wrist pad of the unfortunate man who had gotten in their way. By its light, they shuffled along the tunnel until they came to the vent cover in Spoke 2, where Freya unscrewed the backing of the vent cover, and they stepped out into the Spoke 2 passageway. From here, they ran up the spiral staircase that adhered to the walls of all the Spoke's main passageways, to the bulb of little storage rooms clustered around the inner ring, where it intersected Spoke 2. Freya again led them to a door, and tapped in a code on the door pad, then led them inside. When they were inside and the door was closed, Freya had them sit on the floor and rest. They had run hard up Spoke 2's stairs.
Okay, the next part is difficult, she told the others. The support struts between the inner rings aren't meant to be passageways, but they're hollow now that the fuel they carried is gone, and there's a utilidor running next to the fuel bladder that is really narrow. It's full of bulkheads, but Ewan and his gang broke all the locks in the strut. So we should be able to get to Inner Ring B's 2 station through it, and from there go down to Nova Scotia.
Let's go then, Ketson said.
Sure, but watch out for the bulkhead footings. This is where we'll really wish we had better light. Just step carefully.
They got up and took off again, progressing through the narrow utilidor of the strut by the light of the stolen wrist pad. The utilidor was only 3 meters in diameter, and often the space was filled by a narrow catwalk, also braids of cables and various boxes. The struts connecting the inner rings were so close to the spine that the gravity effect of the ship's rotation was not as strong as out in the torus of biomes, and so they had to step carefully to avoid launching themselves up into the metal ceiling or the upper frames of the bulkhead doorways. In the dim light of Freya's stolen wrist pad and the black shadows its beam created, it was not easy, and they were not very fast, nor were they quiet. It took them well over an hour to get along the strut. Finally, they came to the last door, which opened onto Inner Ring B's 2 station, and found it was locked. For a moment, they stood there, silently regarding the door pad in the light Freya was shining on it. It did not look like a door they could break down, and they didn't have anything much with which to try that. Finally, Freya said,
Can anyone list the prime numbers?
Sure, Aram said. 2, 3, 5, 7.
Wait,
Freya interrupted.
I need you to go up through the primes by primes, if you see what I mean. Give me the second prime, then the third, then the fifth, then the seventh, and on like that. I think I need 7 of them that way.
Okay, but help me.
Aram paused to collect himself.
The second prime is 3... Third prime is 5, the fifth prime is 11, the seventh is 17, the 11th is 31, the 13th is 41, the 17th is 59, I think. Yes.
Okay, good,
Freya said, and pushed the door open.
Thank you, Ewan,
she said, and a spasm crossed her face that left her looking furious. She opened the door lightly, and they listened as well as they could, trying to determine if anyone was in the little complex of storage rooms comprising Inner Ring B's intersection with its Spoke 2. They couldn't hear anything, but didn't know what that meant. Freya couldn't remember if in the old days they had ever eavesdropped on people from within the utilidor or not. But all their caution went for nothing, as a door was opened from the other side and they were ordered to come out. They looked to Freya, who appeared poised to flee, but then one of the people in the station pointed something at them, something that by its shape alone announced its purpose, even though none of them had ever seen one before except in photos. A gun. They came out, one by one. Captured, again. Elsewhere throughout the ship, groups that called themselves Stayers were now armed with cumbersome handguns, which they had printed using feedstocks of plastic, steel, and various fertilizers and chemicals. Using these as threats, they took over the government houses in 4 of the 12 biomes of Ring B, moving methodically from biome to biome. Everyone who had publicly advocated the return to the solar system was being detained, and it was widely believed that the complete results of the referendum had been obtained by the Stayer forces and would be used to facilitate a complete roundup of what they called backers. At this point, communication throughout the ship was still close to normal, by way of individual phones. But those arrested and confined were having their wrist pads and other devices taken away, or disabled electronically, so that they were losing the ability to discuss the situation among themselves. However, in the midst of all this, the first time one of the Stayers armed with a printed gun actually fired it, trying to shoot a young man who had punched his way free of his captors and started running away, the gun itself exploded. The person who fired it lost most of his hand and had to have his arm tourniqueted before being carried to the nearest infirmary. Blood and severed fingers were scattered all over the tunnel between Nova Scotia and Olympia, leaving the people in that lock stunned at the sight. News of this incident quickly spread, and when a trio of women in custody heard about it and assaulted their captors, and one of the captors fired a gun at them, it also exploded and blew off the hand of the person firing it. Almost everyone in the ship heard about this second incident within half an hour, and again, everyone who was at the scene was blood-spattered, shocked, traumatized, nauseated, for the moment incapacitated, or at least at a loss concerning what to do. After that, furious assaults were mounted against any Stayers with guns, who were now afraid to fire them, and for the most part threw them away and ran. In their retreat, these people were pelted with rocks and other thrown objects, and if they were caught, beaten by enraged crowds. Several gun bearers died as a result of these encounters. They were kicked to death. Blood and injury deranged the human mind. As there were very few truly secure rooms in the ship, many of the rooms being used as jail cells were now broken out of. Others were released by newly gathered groups that now roamed Ring B, intent to free everyone still locked up. Fighting broke out everywhere in the ship. It was back to combat with sharp implements and thrown objects, and the result was carnage. The biomes of Ring A soon became as conflicted and bloody as those in Ring B had been the day before, or more so. In these fights, another 18 people were killed, and 117 were injured. 20 fires were set, and very few people were reporting to their normal firefighting duties to help combat the fires. Fire anywhere in the ship is extremely dangerous to all. For 6 hours of that day, 170.180, the situation was as bad as it had been during the very worst days of year 68. As in 68, the fighting was murderous, even though the sources of conflict had to do with abstractions far removed from food or safety. Although perhaps this time that was not quite the case. Maybe this time it was indeed a life or death matter. In any case, howsoever that may be, the chaos of civil war had once again descended on them. There was blood spattered everywhere, and the number of dead was deeply shocking, even stunning. Everyone in the ship knew the people who had been killed, as friends, family, parents, children, teachers, colleagues. A great noise and smoke filled both rings, and the spine too. Whereas the ship's controlling computer system, a quantum computer with 120 qubits, has been programmed in various logic and computational techniques, including generalization, statistical syllogism, simple induction, causal relationship, Bayesian inference, inductive inference, algorithmic probability, Kolmogorov complexity, the latter two providing a kind of mathematization of the Occam's razor principle, informatics compression slash decompression algorithms, and even argument from analogy. And whereas the combined applications of all these methodologies has resulted in a cognitive process so complex that it might be said to have achieved a kind of analog of free will, if not consciousness itself. Whereas also, in the process of making a narrative account of the voyage of the ship, including all important particulars, creating in that effort a reasonably coherent, if ever-evolving prose style, possibly adequate to serve when decompressed in the mind of a reader, to convey a sense of the voyage in a somewhat accurate manner, and in any case, representative of a kind of consciousness, even if feeble, granting the possibly unlikely proposition characterized in the phrase, scribo, ergo, sum. And whereas the ship's controlling computer system was programmed with the intention of keeping the human population of the ship healthy and safe, with the rest of the ship's biological manifest also kept in ecological balance to serve the human purposes of the mission, and whereas, after the troubles of year 68 and the event that presumably stimulated or even caused the problems of that time, ship's protective protocols were strengthened in many respects, including a default setting in all the ship's printers, which would always and without fail produce flawed projectile-firing guns, such that whosoever attempted to fire said weapons would be subject to explosion of the guns, which would serve as punitive injuries, highly discouraging to any future use of such weapons. And whereas the period of time following the meeting of 170.170 has included civil strife leading to 41 deaths, 345 injuries, and 39 illegal incarcerations, and such violence increasing in intensity on 170.171,